This is photographer Hamish Campbell. You're listening to the Petapixel Photography Podcast with Sharky James. Hope you enjoy.
This episode is sponsored by our friends at FreshBooks. The weather is a little chilly. Chilly. And if you're a freelance photographer or small business owner, you'd much rather be shooting the fall colors while there's still time for that than dealing with paperwork, right? And that's where the cloud-based accounting software from FreshBooks comes in. To sign up for your 30-day free trial, go to freshbooks.com/petapixel and enter petapixel in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Thank you so much, FreshBooks. Welcome to the Petapixel Photography Podcast, episode 118, Donald Trump versus copyright. In this episode, a photographer sues the Trump campaign for copyright infringement. Photography portfolio sites are ranked. We discuss photography workshops and what to look out for. A Micro Four Thirds lens that can do something unusual. And a listener wants to know what's up with exposure compensation. All that and more in episode 118 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Thank you so much, Hamish, for opening the show. I greatly appreciate it, brother. Hamish Campbell is a UK-based advertising and commercial photographer and retoucher who, for the past decade or so, has amassed an impressive list of clients, including the Burberry Group, the PGA, Walmart, and more, which has seen him shooting ads all over the world. And in addition to all of that awesomeness, Hamish is often tapped as a consultant, as well as for public speaking gigs. To view some truly stunning photography, head on over to his website at hcampbellphotography.com. That's Campbell with a P, by the way. And I'd like to thank you all for joining us here in episode 118 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. We appreciate you all so much, and thank you all for subscribing, rating, and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever else you listen to us. And as always, we appreciate you hitting that subscribe button so you don't miss a single episode, as well as telling your friends on social media and elsewhere, and helping to get the word out about this show. Okay, with that, I'm your host, Sharky James. Let's hit it. I think we've all about had it with this election season. I'm going to leave it at that because, again, who cares who I'm voting for? It really doesn't matter. I'm just a guy with a photography podcast. No one's going to take any direction from me on who to vote for U.S. president. But we're photographers, and there's an update about the now infamous bowl of Skittles photo that UK-based photographer David Kiddos shot. You know, the one that the Trump campaign apparently used without permission, adding the text, quote, "If I had a bowl of Skittles and I told you that just three would kill you, would you take a handful? That's our Syrian refugee problem," end quote. Now, that graphic was tweeted out from Donald Trump Jr., son of U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump, via his Twitter account this past September 2016, and it sparked a lot of outrage. Not just outrage, it's now sparked a lawsuit. You see, when the photographer posted the photo to his Flickr account back on January 15th of 2010, he chose the all rights reserved designation. You know, that's there for a reason, of course, and no matter who you are, how much money you have, what office you're running for, etc., you can't just take someone's photograph without paying them. And also without asking their permission. Maybe they don't agree with what you agree with. Think about if you were in that position. Usually, campaigns will have somebody search for and properly license imagery because A, they have the money to do so, and B, we're a nation of laws. It's customary to follow them. Imagine that. So obviously, somewhere along the way, someone messed up. You know, it happens. And they use this photographer's image to talk about candidate Trump's stance on the Syrian refugee issue. What makes this especially upsetting, though, to the photographer is that he himself is a refugee, having fled Cyprus way back in 1974. So in his lawsuit, he's named the Trump campaign, Donald Trump, Donald Trump Jr., as well as Donald Trump's running mate, Mike Pence, as defendants. The photographer's lawyers are arguing that it was a unique photo, it was copyrighted, of course, and having been used by the Trump campaign, it was infringed upon. Of this use of his image, the photographer's suit says in part, quote, "The unauthorized use of the photograph is reprehensibly offensive to the plaintiff as he is a refugee of the Republic of Cyprus who was forced to flee his home at the age of 6 years old," end quote. Now, the suit doesn't specify damages, but as it's an unauthorized use, you can be sure that a decent payday is in this photographer's future, especially when you consider how many people have now seen this photo, perhaps millions. He's also seeking an injunction to keep the photo from further being used, and seeing as how it's his photo, that seems perfectly reasonable, I think we would all agree. If not, why do we even have laws? Again, I don't care if it's a candidate, a cause, a business, your mom, it doesn't matter. It's just not right to take someone else's photo. Taking something that is not yours without paying for it is technically stealing. So pay the guy. You know, it's the right thing to do. Next. Last episode, we had a listener question from John who, when asked by a friend what he thought about her photography, actually lied to her. He heard that episode and says he'll be taking my advice, which was to guide her purchase of new gear and encouraging her to get some training so she can put the pieces together and up her game. Apparently, she hasn't progressed much after years of shooting, and sometimes what's necessary is snapping up video training like that 5-day deal, watching videos on YouTube, and my other suggestion, taking workshops, if money allows, of course. I don't think I've talked to someone yet who regretted taking a good workshop. And the key there is a good one. So many photographers use this as part of their business model, and they've barely launched their photography business themselves. You know, it's part of that rock star photographer mentality for many. Not everyone is going to be a Jerry Gionis or a Lindsay Adler. You know, those people have been around for a long time and have earned their stripes. When they teach a workshop, you know it's going to be good because they know what they're talking about. They've established themselves. They didn't just open a photography business and thought, you know what? Teaching workshops, that's where the money's at. I'm going to do that. In my opinion, it takes years of seriously working at your craft or incredible talent before you should even expect people to pay you to learn what you know. Even worse are these photographers who set out to take a workshop themselves and then blatantly steal the PowerPoint presentations, the materials, the teaching style, and so much more, and then just pretty much rebrand it as their own. Like nobody would ever figure that out. The advice that I give to people is to carefully research the workshops that you're thinking about taking before you pull the trigger on them, because you know what? They are not cheap. The good ones, though, are so, so worth it. You'll pick up so many great things from them that it'll be definitely worth the money and could save you years of frustration. If you happen to hear me on This Week in Photo, episode 486 recently, host Frederick Van Johnson, Martin Bailey, and I were talking about Martin's incredible workshops. Now, to be fair, I've never taken them, but everyone that has raves about them. And Martin surely knows his stuff. I mean, it's Martin Bailey. He is the real deal, no doubt. On that episode, we were talking about one of his workshops where, among other things, you can photograph those snow monkeys in the hot springs or whatever it is. You know what I'm talking about. The snow monkeys with snow and ice on them as they're chilling and bathe themselves in that warm bath. Those snow monkeys. You've seen them on TV. You've seen them in pictures. You know what I'm talking about here. I thought the whole workshop was photographing the snow monkeys, but as Martin pointed out, that's just one part of a larger tour with cranes and other fun things that you can photograph. So it really shouldn't be surprising that that particular workshop is booked up all the way into 2018. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Now, one of these years, I'm going to go to Japan, meet Martin for the first time, that's one, and also take that workshop. You know, snow monkeys, I got to do that sometime in my life, right? That is on my bucket list. Photograph the snow monkeys in Japan, specifically with Martin Bailey. Anyhow, I followed up with Martin yesterday to see what was available because I know a lot of you are looking for great workshops. And as I record this, there's just one spot left in his epic Namibia tour in June of 2017. But he has a few more spots open on his Hokkaido landscape photography adventure, and that's coming up in January of 2017. I think that many people would actually really enjoy that one. You know, I can't do nearly as good a job as Martin as explaining what that workshop is like. So for that, head on over to bit.ly/winterlandscape, all lowercase, or you can hit the show notes for episode 118 at petapixel.com/podcast, where I'll have the link to that, or you can go to martinbaileyphotography.com. Any of those are going to get you there. I had to look it up because I don't know Japan's geography, but Hokkaido is the northernmost island there. And if you check out the page that he has set up for you, you'll see that there are some amazing winter landscapes that you'd be shooting if you were there on the workshop with him. This is the kind of stuff that you see on posters, in magazines, etc. And Martin would show you how to shoot those and make them look amazing. Now, if you listen to his podcast, you already know this, but he leads workshops and tours to places like Iceland, which is green, Greenland, which is icy, and Antarctica, as well as Namibia and a bunch of other places. So if any of these interest you, I think it's worth heading on over there and to check it out, if for no other reason than to see incredible photography. I mean, he's got a lot of great stuff over there. Martin, as I said, also has a great podcast as well. One of the oldest, in fact, and also he's a great guy. Next. It's not at all going to surprise you that I often get asked which portfolio site is best to use these days. And honestly, I don't know. I don't use any of them. And if I did, I couldn't possibly use them all and keep up to date with what they're all doing, right? So I keep my ear to the ground and I recommend what I hear people telling me they use the most and seem to like. Well, thankfully, the peeps over at WiseBuyer were able to find the time to get to the bottom of this by asking over 800 actual subscribers of 13 of the most popular portfolio builders and asked them how satisfied they are with their choice. You know, whether or not you feel like you're trapped in the system that you're in right now, if someone asks you if you're happy or not, you're going to tell them. So this data, I think, should be pretty darn solid. They asked these hundreds of photographers if they would recommend their choice to their friends, and here are the results. Solidly in first place with 95% satisfaction is Format. Now, what business wouldn't want that kind of customer satisfaction, right? WiseBuyer also asked what they liked and didn't like about each service, and of Format, what they heard the most was that it was easy to use, affordably priced, had great templates that were highly customizable, and those templates showed their work off beautifully when they were viewed on mobile devices. And it's that last part that is really key here. Not everyone has a computer these days. Photographers do, but most people are consuming the vast majority of content via their phones and tablets. Even if they have a computer, they're likely to use their phone rather than go sit down at a computer and check out your photography. That's just how it is these days, you know, and it's not likely to change. So looking great on a mobile device, if you're displaying your work and that's really important to you, is key. Now, as for what users didn't like about the service, there wasn't a consistent theme. You know, with other services, there was, but with Format, there wasn't. And that is a great sign for them. People are gonna have their gripes, you know I do, but when there's not one that stands out, you know that that's likely to be a great choice for many people. Now, in second place was 22 Slides, and people said that they loved their customer service. They also loved how intuitive it was to use everything, and being affordable was another plus. What users said that they didn't like, though, was that it wasn't very video-friendly, and that's going to be a deal-breaker for many of us photographers. Video, of course, is a great way to promote your work, whether you're talking about your work, or you're doing a slideshow set to music, or whatever. Or maybe you're a photography business that also shoots video. So with 22 Slides, you might not be as happy as with using Format or another service. Now, coming in third was SmugMug. I used to have a SmugMug account like, I don't know, almost 10 years or so ago. Haven't used them in forever. But their customers right now love the incredibly quick customer service that they have, as well as their printing and e-commerce solutions. And it has unlimited storage. So that was huge, pun intended. The downside, though, was the lack of a blogging functionality, and they felt like the user interface was a little more complicated than it really needs to be. Now, in case you're wondering, at the very bottom of the list, with 69% satisfaction, according to WiseBuyer, was ViewBook. Users loved the iPad app for showing off their work, but they said that the service overall is difficult to use and isn't very customizable. Second up from the bottom, and quite frankly surprising, was Zenfolio. You know, they've been around forever as well, but they came in at just 70% satisfaction. Their users didn't have anything good to say that they could point to, one thing that stood out. But as for things that they disliked, they said that there's been a problem with downtime, templates were fairly limited, and they also said that the service overall wasn't very easy to use. If you're interested in seeing the entire list and perhaps where your particular service is ranked, hit the show notes for episode 118 at petapixel.com /podcast. Next. Squirrel. No, seriously, I get distracted a lot. And one thing that I hate doing is paperwork. This episode is sponsored by FreshBooks, as you know, and they've managed to up their game by improving their already ridiculously easy-to-use cloud-based accounting solution so you could get in, get out, and get back to doing the stuff that you really enjoy, like photography. Why on earth would you put yourself through slow torture when you can make your life easier, you know? All right, so check this out. With FreshBooks, you can brand your invoices with your logo and your color scheme. You can accept online payments with ease, set auto payment reminders, and according to their data, FreshBooks users get paid 2 weeks faster, cut 2 days a month off administrative tasks, and double their revenue in the first 24 months. That makes sense, right? More time to shoot means making more money and not shuffling papers. You know, many photographers lose their passion for photography when it becomes a business. So alleviate some of that pain and make sure you're getting paid. FreshBooks also lets you keep track of your receipts, organize your expenses, and with tax time around the corner, you'll be more prepared, less stressed, and can get away from the desk and actually shoot. Their mobile app, by the way, is awesome. You can take pics of your receipts, check to see who's paid you, who hasn't, even chat with your clients live, and so much more, all right from there in the app. You know, while you're out shooting. You see a pattern here? They want you to do what you love, and that's not invoicing the old way. I want you to see why they're the number one cloud accounting solution and why over 10 million small business owners choose FreshBooks. And for your 30-day free trial, head on over to freshbooks.com/petapixel and enter petapixel in the how did you hear about us section. No credit card is required, and you can cancel at any time. You know, FreshBooks and listeners like you, of course, make this show possible. The squirrel, too. I'm sure he had something to do with it. Yeah, I'm nuts. I better watch out for that squirrel, huh? Next. Today's listener question comes from John in Connecticut.
Hello, Sharky. John Parisi from Colebrook, Connecticut. What's the difference between using the exposure compensation of, say, +1 or just changing the f-stop? Thanks, I appreciate all the information I'm getting from the show. Bye.
I'm so happy that you asked about this, John, because this one confuses a lot of people. And you know what? I don't check out the camera manuals much, but when I have checked them, they don't do a good job at all of explaining this stuff. So we're going to have a bit of a deep dive here. And for those of you that already know this stuff, maybe don't hit the fast forward button yet. See if I explain it well and let me know. All right, for those that don't know, exposure compensation is a way of quickly changing your exposure from the value that your camera says is its best guess for a proper exposure. Now, while cameras today have a better dynamic range and do a pretty good job of metering scenes, if you're shooting a subject with the sun behind them, let's say, they're probably going to be in silhouette and severely underexposed. Your camera sees that scene, sees a lot of light, and decides to darken everything down in an attempt to get the best exposure. But what if that's not what you want to do? Let's say you're photographing your wife in that scene and you don't have a flash, but you want to see her and you don't care about the background. Now, I would argue that it might be better to shoot in the other direction because what you're going to have to do to get a photo of her where she's properly exposed is overexpose that scene. So what's going to happen is everything is going to lighten up together, and while she might be properly exposed, that background is going to be completely blown out. I mean, it could be beautiful back there. You could have the sun setting, and it's gorgeous, but you're not going to see it because everything is going supernova on you. You might be able to recover some of that if you shoot raw and keep an eye on your histogram, making sure you don't overexpose to the point where there's no data and it's all white in certain areas. But maybe you don't want to deal with all that later. And or maybe you don't even care about the background at that point. You know, maybe the idea is to just get a nice photo of your lovely wife. So what do? You dial in some exposure compensation. Now, on many cameras, this is going to be a button that's going to have a square on it. On Nikons, it's a white plus sign against a black background in the top left. And in the bottom right portion, it's a black minus sign against a white background. So picture a yin-yang symbol, but not exactly. Now, on my Fujifilm X-T2, which the kind folks at DigiDirect down in Australia sent me, it is a wonderful dial that's dedicated to this. You can turn it either way, and it'll give you plus or minus 3 stops of compensation in 1/3 stop increments, and that is awesome. With your eye to the electronic viewfinder, you can not only see the scale changing along the side, since it's a mirrorless body, you can actually see your exposure change. That's why I think that for many beginning photographers, mirrorless is a great option to go. You're turning the dial and you're immediately seeing what's going on. So you turn it until you see a nice photo and you take the picture. How easy is that? I mean, isn't that how it should be? And this is versus a DSLR where you have to take a shot, maybe dial in more or less compensation, take another shot, and repeat until you have the photograph that you want. On DSLRs, this is usually done by a button, like I described, where it's got the plus and minus symbol on it. So you press that, and then you turn a thumb wheel. Plus one is going to brighten things up by a stop, while minus one will darken it by a stop. Going back many, many years, I've always thought as, you know, ground level, let's say, you know, in our real world, ground level is zero. Minus is below the ground, plus is above the ground. So minus would, of course, be dark because it's under the ground where it's dark. And that's a really silly way of explaining it. But I think that a lot of people right now are like, oh, it's all clicking right now. No pun intended. That makes a lot of sense. Now, as you dial in exposure compensation, in your viewfinder, you're usually going to see a black rectangle, or it might be a white rectangle, move below or beside a representation of a scale that's going to show you how many stops you have dialed in. Canon and Nikon do this differently, though. Just as their lenses turn the opposite ways to zoom, their compensation scales do so as well. Canon uses numbers and has underexposure minus to the left, while Nikon uses dots and dashes, and going left actually means overexposing. So that would be plus, not minus. Now, I don't know who the genius was and which company did this first, but one of them deviated from what the other was doing. So Canon or Nikon was doing it one way, and the other company thought, you know what? I think it'd be a great idea if we do it the opposite way and distinguish ourselves. Now, whichever company that was, thank you very much for nothing. You know, you did a disservice to the photography community many, many decades ago. Seriously, if they owned, or now own for that matter, the competitor's camera and then buy yours, tell me that discovering things go in the opposite direction doesn't tick them off. So good job. Way to go. Someone knows the answer to this. And if you do, let me know on social media, please. I'm Lens Shark everywhere. Okay, so I probably could have answered your question by saying that exposure compensation is what you're going to use when you're in anything but manual mode. You could dial it in while you're in manual, but that usually doesn't do anything. You're in manual because you want to choose your shutter speed, your aperture, and your ISO, what we call the exposure triangle. But let's say you're in aperture priority mode. Dialing in compensation will change your shutter speed. And if you're in shutter priority mode, doing so will change your aperture. So your camera is metering in those modes, and as you move your camera around, things are changing. You know, the scene is changing, the lighting is changing, and so your exposure is changing. Whatever it says at any particular point, dialing in one stop of overexposure, which is plus one, will take that scene, then overexpose it by one stop. If your subject is seriously backlit, though, as in my example of your wife with a beautiful sunset behind her, it'll take more than that, probably. But remember, the whole scene brightens up together. This is why we usually introduce flash or a reflector to bounce light back onto the subject and kind of bring that dynamic range kind of closer together for that exposure. Now, before I forget, if you're in the Canon system and you switch to Nikon and you're used to minus going in one direction versus minus going the opposite direction in your new camera, you can go into your settings usually and switch it to what you're used to. So thank you, whatever camera companies that do this, for putting that in the menus. That is very, very helpful to us. The zoom rings, however, on your lenses, well, you're out of luck there. Unless you buy Sigma's offerings, because those all turn in the Canon direction. So imagine when I'm using my Nikon D500 and I've got an actual Nikon lens on it and it goes in one direction when I zoom. When I use one of my awesome Sigma lenses, it has to go in the opposite direction. So I think that I'm zooming in and I'm actually zooming out. And that is really annoying. But what can you do? They're great lenses. I'm still going to use them. Thanks again for your question, John. I really appreciate it, brother. And I think you helped a lot of people out by asking it. Next. There's a cool new lens that's out for Micro Four Thirds camera systems that can see yesterday. Okay, it can't exactly do that, but it's the next best thing. It can actually see behind itself. The Antonia 250 Fisheye MFT has an astounding 250-degree field of view, which, since we understand math kinda sorta after all these years, means that it's more than 180 degrees, and that does include things that are to the sides, as well as behind it by a decent amount. Now, mind you, it's not the extremely hard to find Nikon 6mm f2.8, which was first released in 1979, but it's also not insanely expensive either. We're talking fancy car to starter home expensive. This MFT lens isn't in production yet, and it's still in development, so they've made clear that the specs may very well change, but they've got designs for three different focal lengths. A 2.3mm f2.8, a 3mm f2.8, and a 3.6mm f4. So, since these are for Micro Four Thirds bodies, you double that focal length, and you get a 4.6, a 6, and a 7.2mm, respectively. They've released a photo that was shot with that 3.6mm f4 and an Olympus Pen F body, which you can see if you hit the show notes. And honestly, I really don't get this whole fisheye thing. Why? Just why, I ask you. If you're very creative and you get up close to your subject, then that might be kind of cool. But these kind of lenses really aren't spending a whole lot of time on your camera, are they? Unless you're distinguishing yourself as the go-to person for fisheye photography, it's just not happening. You know, there's probably a reason why there isn't a go-to person for fisheye photography. Just saying. All right, that was especially curmudgeon-y even for me. I mean, can you imagine what I'm going to be like in 20 years from now when I'm 65? By then, I'll be like, this lens, don't buy it, next. This other lens, this camera, whatever, don't buy it, next. Okay, I don't think I'll be nearly that bad, but you know what? Many of you tell me that what you appreciate the most from me is that I'm not all rah-rah about every product that comes out. You know, you're going to get my impressions, and my impressions of this lens is that I can't imagine many people buying it. For one, they say it's going to cost about $3,500 US when it comes out. Now I ask you, if you've got that kind of money to burn on a lens with limited practical usefulness, what are the chances that you're shooting with little tiny town Micro Four Thirds bodies? Pretty slim, right? If that's how you're spending your money, you've probably got a Leica, in which case, it's about time for my dental exam, doc. Hey, they're the go-to camera system for dentists. Everybody knows this. It's okay. We say it lovingly. In all seriousness, though, the real reason, of course, is that these types of lenses seem destined for the 360-degree video market because this company has done work in that area before. This particular lens is an ultra-ultra-wide fisheye. This isn't the kind that you get when you think about getting a fisheye lens on a whim, and then you use it once, and then you put it away in your drawer. Can you tell I'm not a big fan of fisheye photography? I'm sorry, that's just how it is. I'd like to thank you all for listening to episode 118 of the Petapixel Photography Podcast. Don't forget to check us out at petapixel.com/podcast for the show notes and to see what else we have for you. Just like another John did this week, if you head on over there, you can leave me a voicemail question that we can answer here on the show. Or if you don't feel comfortable leaving a voicemail, feel free to email me at lensshark@gmail.com. And if you'd like to connect with me personally, and I hope you do, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook where I'm Lensshark. That's LENSSHARK. And don't forget, a great way to support this show is to check out our sponsor, FreshBooks. So head on over to freshbooks.com/petapixel and get your 30-day free trial. They've revamped the system. It looks awesome, and I want you guys to check it out. All right, with that, I'll see you all in episode 119. Well, it's f8 and 250th of a second outside. It's time to shoot.
Please subscribe to the Petapixel Photography Podcast. My daddy is the host.
The unauthorized use of the photograph is reprehensibly offensive to the plaintiff as he is a refugee of the Republic of Cyprus who was forced to flee his home at the age of 6 years old. It sounds like I have a code there, and I do not. I'm always stuffed up. Anyhow, as well as Trump's running pate, there's another blooper. Car. I wonder if you could hear the car in the background, though. I mean, it's distracting as you're recording, but if it's not in there, that's fine, but still. Come on.